Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we'd love to tell their stories. New Chocolates in Brooklyn offers delicious and classic combination truffles and caramels, sweet, salty, some even with beer. Using single-origin cocoa beans, production takes place right in their shop on Atlantic Avenue. Come have a taste in one of our six Manhattan locations.
Good morning. You're listening to Taste Matters on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Mitchell Davis, your host, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we talk about taste with interesting people and interesting perspectives about this concept of food, this thing food that we all love and that we think about and talk about endlessly. And today, I'm with someone who probably has been at or seen or sampled or been a part of more wonderful things in the food world than just about anybody. Clark Wolf, a great consultant of ideas in restaurants and a mover. What do you do, Clark? Tell me.
I do a lot of things.
How do you describe yourself?
A tall, silver-haired.
That's all true. I can say that's true. Slim, fit, well-dressed.
Well, thank you. No, actually, I do a lot of things, but I'm a food and restaurant business consultant, and okay. I've been doing that for over 30 years.
And you cover the country. We're not just talking about little local things happening in Brooklyn here, but you are bi-coastal. You live both in Sonoma and in New York City.
I live in a 100-year-old logger's cabin in the Redwoods in northwestern Sonoma County, and I do that partly because the food is from Sonoma County. We can talk about that in a bit, but you know, I've been in New York since 1982. I was brought here by Barbara Kafka to help her do something called Star Spangled Foods. Not a good syntax, but a good idea. It had to do with regional American foods. And then I started doing restaurants because I knew what the food was. You know, when I started, I had been a waiter on the railroad between Oakland and Chicago.
Really?
Did you know that?
No, that's news to me. Okay.
I was a waiter on the Silver Zephyr. Wow. 2.5 days there, 26-hour layover, 2.5 days back. And it was the 70s, and it was the early 70s, and they had leftover equipment. So sometimes we were riding the rails with a kitchen that had a wood-burning stove. Oh, my God. We served 600 people in 48 seats in under 2 hours at 90 miles an hour.
Of course, we're going back to that here with Roberta's and their portable
we're in the hood. They didn't know how precious that was. We served fledgling processed food that was pretty lousy, but what we ate that was cooked mostly by old African-American cooks who had been there for a long time, what we ate was astounding, and wow. It woke my eyes up and my ears and my mouth, and I fell in love with it. I was always in a starch white shirt and, you know, manicured and clipped, and I got to learn from other people. I learned a lot about the restaurant business because I'd never been on a train or waited at a table in my life.
Not the first person to lie your way into the restaurant business.
Well, I mean, yeah, you're not supposed to put that on your resume. Lied really well, yeah. And ended up in a great spot. But I'd get to Chicago, and I'm a Valley boy. I was Deborah Winger's youth group leader. I grew up in the Valley, but it had some great advantages. Among them, tangerines and Meyer lemons in the backyard.
Amazing.
You know, apricots. We waited until watermelons were 3 cents a pound in the height of the season, not the beginning, the height. And they tasted the best and they were the cheapest. I had benchmarks in my mouth. We knew what tomatoes tasted like. And when I was
had
a kid,
benchmarks in your mouth.
We should talk
we'll
about
leave that alone. Yeah, that's for another show.
No, we won't. As a matter of fact, we're going to go deeply
right
into
exactly.
it. Anyway, but I grew up in the Valley, and I had an aunt who was a gal Friday at William Morris. Uh-huh, well. And when I was 11 years old, apparently.
Very mad man.
And I was in a hallway at William Morris, and she had one of those pony skirts, you know, tight in the middle. And well, anyway, Auntie Shirley, we called her. She said, Clarky, that's what they called me. Do it again and you're dead. But she, Clarky, Elvis Clark. I mean, you know what? But she would take me to Chasen's and Perino's and the Brown wow. Derby. And I was this little kid in a little suit. And I loved it. You know, table by the window, please. I wanted good service. I loved the completeness of it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I love the food. I grew up in all of that. But then when I moved to San Francisco later on, long story short, I went to school at San Francisco State University and got a really good education and virtually no help. I mean, that's what, the not Yale, right? So you get a good education until Ronald Reagan tried to destroy that educational system. It was a brilliant education with wonderful people. And then we were out on our own to do stuff. And I ended up opening a cheese and wine shop at the base of Nob Hill because I saw a sign in a window. You know, in San Francisco, and in Brooklyn, it used to be very much that way too. Mm-hmm. There would be a sign, apartment for rent.
Right.
And it would tell you how much and the phone number. I mean, you know what I mean? And right. roommate wears funny dresses, whatever. And the same thing for jobs. So there was a sign in a window. I had a no account roommate who wasn't working. And he came back and said, this is the job for you. It was to open and manage a little cheese and wine shop wow. at the base of Nob Hill, San Francisco in 1976, mm-hmm. when people still call that runny stuff braai, mm-hmm. right? Second week of my employment, the company that owned it went Chapter 11. I had $200 and 32 cheeses, and I learned what a business does and does not need to stay afloat. Wow. That it was, I ran it for 2.5 years mm-hmm. as it was sold and closed the other store that they had in San Mateo. I really learned across the counter. I learned how to bring out living food and take care of them every day mm-hmm. and help them be enhanced. And I learned the value of things and how to express it in a way that people would embrace. I'll give you an example. We had something called Italian Fontal, and it was in a wonderful wooden box with a copper edged clamp. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I'd pay money for the box now, right? And I couldn't give it away at $5 a pound.
Wow.
And then I charged $8.50 and said only 22 pounds left, the whole wheel, just in, and we sold it out in about a day and a half.
Right. So you learned a lot of good lessons in that shop.
So many. And I ended up getting hired to be the cheese guy at what was going to become the legendary Oakville Grocery. This is a 1930s general store in the Napa Valley on Highway 29 across from the Mondavi Winery. And Bob Mondavi was bringing amazing chefs from all over Europe, the Great Chefs of France program. So here you have this little general store, mm-hmm. usually visited by migrant farm workers for beer and pretzels and whatnot. And you had the Great Chefs of France saying, can you get me extra virgin olive oil and whole grain mustard mm-hmm. and eventually foie gras and caviar and curried right, spices.
And the world exploded.
And right. the world exploded. Right. And so I helped redo that store. And then I helped open the one in San Francisco in 79-80. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about the timing.
Sure. It's an amazing time. I mean, especially you, when I think in the context of James Beard and sort of all of the people in New York who were helping people discover food that was also here, but less perhaps part of the everyday life, less part of everyone's culture.
The point is there was a very strong connection. Let's face facts. Many of the people in Northern California that were at the forefront and are at the forefront of food development and the culture mm-hmm. of those things was at least bicoastal. Jim Beard was bicoastal.
Sure,
he lived, in that little cheese shop in 78, the door darkened one day and in he walked. I'll tell that story some other time. But, you know, there was a very strong connection,
sure.
partly because of wine country. Partly because the farms were
growing,
there. The
right.
growing was there. Mm-hmm. You know, Alice Waters is from New Jersey. She's a former Montessori teacher. Jeremiah Tower, who was legendary with Alice at Chez Panisse and went on to have Stars Restaurant and do a lot of really important things in that period of time, is from Connecticut.
Right.
So there was a great crosshatch. Mm-hmm. And when I came here in 82, brought by Barbara Kafka, then the food editor of Vogue, there was a very strong sense that Northern California was training ground development, an open vein to the real stuff. I want to say about the Bay Area, it's for many years been my secret weapon. If you want to learn about food in America, go to Northern California mm-hmm. and see what they're tasting and arguing about. Their idea of a return on the investment is visceral. They want the food to be good. They want the evening to be memorable. They're less concerned with money. Not to say that there isn't plenty,
right.
But they are really much less concerned. So they work harder for less in a monetary sense and for much greater depth and range, you know, in a visceral sense. And in San Francisco, and I'm sure this is true in other pockets of the country, but particularly there, mm-hmm. people who are in the Hong Kong neighborhood are from Hong Kong and have relatives still in Hong Kong.
Right.
People from Liguria, from the Italian Riviera, have relatives still in Liguria. It is not a melting pot. Trust mm-hmm. me when I tell you, I mean, New York has been a melting pot. Now, New York is a brilliant crossroads. New York City is just so exciting mm-hmm. On the food scene, but you have to remember that they were roasting coffee and learning how to roast coffee like Dutch chocolate in Berkeley at Pete's before Starbucks was born. And in New York, a regular coffee was thin, burnt in a blue and white paper cup yes. with milk and 2 sugars. So, you know, I mean, the evolution of the palate is extraordinary. I got to learn about these things. I brought arugula.
Listening, yes.
To California in 1980.
Really?
Because somebody said to me, can you get the Italian rocket? Because Alice was having right. these little wild hen-gathered, you know, spiky leaves. And so he said, arugula. Arugula? Oh, I had that at a... And I got it the first year for the Oakville Grocery in San Francisco, and it was $18 a pound.
Wow.
In the middle of the season, some farmer walked in and said, oh, I can grow that. It's a weed. And the next year, it was 89 cents a bunch.
Amazing.
So the point is, I was surrounded by this.
Sure. Let me interrupt you for a sec, because it should be no question to the listeners why we've invited you here, especially at this time of year, because I wanted to talk about trends. We're at the moment where we're all thinking about what's going on, what happened this year, what might happen next year. At the Beard Foundation, we just published our own sense of what we've noticed and what we expect to see in 2012 on our blog on jamesbeard.org. And one of the trends I wanted to talk to you about, and I should say that if people have any questions, they can call us in at 718-497-2128. You can also email us questions at info@heritageradionetwork.com. But one of the things I wanted to ask you about is not just the consumption of food, but one of the things that's exploded is the talking about food, the reading about food. You can't open, there's a new food book, a new food movie, a new chef on a TV show. And you're responsible for a great series of conversations about food that I think are really important, because part of a food culture isn't just eating, isn't just growing, but there's all of the other cultural things that come around.
Well, it's knowing.
It is knowing, right.
Let's be honest. Food is the most important thing in the world. And I'm not being facetious, and I'm not writing for New York Magazine. The fact is, without it, we're dead.
Right.
I mean, it really is the most important thing. After World War I and II, we were so frightened, and we were so glad to be here, and we were so well-fed for the first time and warm and all those good things. We really didn't want to talk about it. You know, some cultures, they get very fat to prove they're far away from starvation. Mm-hmm. We got very thin to prove that we have time to get fat.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's how
a nice way to put it, right?
That's how safe we are.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that we were very grateful for that. And so we didn't want to look at it for a long time. Also, cultural stuff and Puritans and all that other kind of stuff, you know, binge and purge. You know, we come from a background of too much and then nothing. Well, what's evolved is that, and you know, because you have a PhD, I got to help Marion Nestle, Dr. Marion Nestle, who is the most trusted and beloved and smartest and sometimes funniest, and she eats a cookie, by the way, nutritional biologist or scientist and professor at NYU. I got to help her to create the Department of Food Studies at Food Studies, Nutrition, and Public Health. And it was because it's a liberal arts and sciences education. I only could afford to learn how to learn. I have a degree in English literature because that's what I could afford to do. And think about it. If everyone had their basic higher education grounded in what we eat, why we eat it, how it grows, how it works in the world, chemistry, biology, international politics, finance, all those things that are culture, history, we'd all be better citizens, you know, and we'd all have better lunch. So getting to do that for her was really kind of wonderful and was at a time when people simply wanted to know more. You know, we used to do it ad hoc. I was the kid, and Julia Child and Bob Mondavi and the late Richard Graff from Chalon Vineyards started this thing called the American Institute of Wine and Food. Along the same times, Chris Kimball at Cook's Magazine, now it's now Cook's Illustrated, wanted to do something to acknowledge the people who were making good food in America. And the first year he did the Who's Who, which is now the Who's Who at the James Beard Foundation. It was the precursor there. Acknowledge people who were James Beard and Julia Child and Craig Claiborne and all these first 50 people. I got to help pick the first cheesemaker, Laura Chanel Chev. There was this forager, I swear to God, his name is Jeff Hivid. If you're out there in Brooklyn, Jeff, we want to know where you are. Ruth Reichel and I can't find you, but we can remember how to say your name. I mean, this is, you know, 80, I don't know, 4 or something.
Yeah, 84, 85. Right.
Yeah, it was really early on. So Chris gathered all these people together and we gave awards in various categories. And at the end of it, I said, hey, Chris, great idea, lousy party, because we couldn't talk to each other. We didn't have enough to eat. So he made me do it for 5 years. And I got to talk to the purveyors, the people who were raising those heritage pigs long before they were popular. And the jams that came from fruit trees that were down the road or on the property. You know, it takes 30 years to have things be an instant success.
Right, of course.
I mean, that's what happened. So in terms of trends, for a long time, you know, if you take a look at Spain and you take a look at molecular gastronomy or whatever you want to call it, and it's basically artistic silliness. It's basically cellular fiber.
Soluble.
Thank
fiber.
You. In other words, it's, you know, greasing the wheels. And that's great. And it's fascinating and it's wonderful. But it was Spain's adolescence. And remember, in adolescence, as we grow as a culture, at adolescence, you have bad skin and you do a lot of stupid stuff. And God bless, and your hair is blue and all that stuff. And it's really good that Spain did that. They were good things. Ours was in the 80s. We tried everything. We blackened redfish. Now trends are deeper. And I really do want to talk about that, because we have a broader understanding, a broader basic understanding. The conversation is much more interesting and important. And at the Critical Topics in Food series at the FAILS Rare Books and Collections, at the Food Studies Collections at the Bopes Library at NYU. God, it's fun to
That's
say
a
that.
Long word phrase, yeah.
It's I've gotten 3 to 5 times a year to lead conversations that are designed to stimulate and hopefully annoy you enough to have everybody in the group learn more about it. You can actually see them online because they're archived.
Well, we're going to take a break and apologize to all our friends listening in Spain, and we'll be right back.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people $1.50 just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please don't it always seem to go that you don't know.
Welcome back to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Clark Wolf, whose title as restaurant business consultant just doesn't really say enough, because no matter where something is happening, Clark either has just been there, is on his way, or has an opinion about it, even if he has never had anything to do with it. And so post-molecular, post-Spain, let's talk a little bit about some trends in America. In particular, I want to talk about sort of the eruption of, or the creation of Las Vegas as a food town, which I think in some ways is the most American of all food towns in a certain way.
It is. You know, I got to work there a lot. I got to do the first and second wave of restaurants at Mandalay Bay. And every one of those restaurants is still operating and running, and it's been successful. They were all freestanding real businesses, and they were all based on people using ingredients from real places. You know, in Vegas, right. There used to be really good ingredients, but it was only in the high roller room, and it was a secret. Then we helped them notice that California was right there.
Right.
I mean, in point of fact, there are more farms near Las Vegas than near San Francisco or Los Angeles. Right. It's in the middle. You know what I mean? It's kind of astounding. So, and if you realize that 45% to 50% of the people who come to Las Vegas are from California, they know what an aged steak tastes like. They know what a ripe tomato tastes like. You don't have to dumb down anything. And so I got to work in Las Vegas, and I figured if people would have a nice glass of wine and a good meal in Las Vegas, even if it was in a rush, we would really fundamentally change the palate of America in about 10 seconds. Because once it was there and everybody else came from everywhere else in the world, there would be a very strong, comfortable movement. It was more about, as you said, an ease with the discussion about food. You know, the French talk about food all the time. Mm-hmm. The Italians are only talking about what's next, mm-hmm. absolutely, and what just happened. But if you take 100 Italians and you talk about a topic, they will argue like crazy, but it's nuance. They're all talking about the same stuff. You talk about trends, Mitchell. My feeling is that in the near and mid-range future, the huge trend that's very exciting to me and to anybody who eats, which is, I believe, everyone, mm-hmm. the trend is in the real flavors of actual foods. The trend is in heirloom varieties of stuff that have real flavor, that no longer have to be doctored because what they've been raised to be is so vestigial. You know, the first time I was with Florence Fabricant, and we were fortunate enough to be in Paris, and she writes for the New York Times, you know who that is, right?
Of course.
And she told me the story about how the first time she tasted real wild chanterelle mushrooms that had been carefully, slowly sautéed in butter and white wine, and then salted just at the end when you need to, because if you do it too soon, all the moisture comes out and they end up being rubber bands. She tasted them and she said, oh, now I get it. She'd only ever tasted certain wild mushrooms from a can. Wow. And until you taste the real thing, you can't figure out what they're going for. A little bit of chanterelle is kind of cool, especially if you know what it tastes like.
Right.
So I think the biggest trend is going to be deeper, real flavors from real food.
And so how does that trend, do you think, play out? Because I agree, and I don't think it's just a trend, but I think it's a really fundamentally important organizing principle for the whole food system. We're talking constantly about how it's something's broken, we've lost all sense of what's real. And I think that one of the ways into it for people on a personal level is because these things actually taste better. But it's difficult to talk about that, and it's difficult to even deliver that to some people because we live in a time of engineered tastes.
No. Actually, you know what? You know when they say to you on television now, and it's constant, your body doesn't know the difference between corn syrup and sugar. Mine does. I'm sorry, mister. I mean, it may not know chemically in my blood system, but it does in my mouth. Mm. Hello. Right. So all we have to do is deliver the flavors of heritage turkeys and heirloom pork and real tomatoes and various... And remember... the first tomato was pear-shaped and yellow, and it didn't have a lot of flavor. It had a particular kind of flavor. What we're talking about is the involvement with man and nature. I am not against crossbreeding and letting nature mm-hmm. do what it does over and over again. You know, I live in Northern California partly because Luther Burbank, who was the Henry Ford and Thomas Edison of food, lived there, said it was the Eden of all the earth. I mean, it's not above San Francisco. Believe me, it's in the center, surrounded mm-hmm. by Mendocino, the Napa Valley, Marin County, and the Pacific Ocean, and wild salmon and redwood trees and rivers. And I live near the Russian River and the Russian River Valley, known for its foggy nights and sunny days and Pinot Noir and all that stuff. But it's also where he bred 980 different heirloom varieties, amazing varieties of fruits, vegetables, and flowers, and all kinds of other good stuff that had real flavor, that met human need, but in a thoughtful, sustainable way. Gravenstein apples, and you know, Slow Food as an organization has tried to preserve it, put it on the ark.
James Beard wrote about them ceaselessly.
All right. Yeah. You know why they were bred to harvest in the summer? I mean, practically, so the whole family could help. Mm. All right. Now, I'm working with a group that has, we started planting Luther Burbank school orchards so that kids in school gardens can learn to grow, harvest, and I don't know, steal, you know, fruit from trees, from their own trees, right? Well, the kids come to school in the fall, so we can't have Gravensteins. So we have something called a Winterstein that Luther Burbank developed in 1901 that came into perfect ripeness just after school starts. So it could be something that you could have at home in front of the house and you could put in your lunch. I mean, it's really practical. The idea that you go into a huge store and it says conventional produce next to organic produce is misleading at best. I'm being polite, mm-hmm. not as nice as I was about Spain, but I'm being polite. It's not conventional farming is organic. I mean, it's natural. That's industrial farming and chemical farming. You can size up farming. The reason I live in Northern California is we have to feed a lot of people. I will not demonize farmers. I'm sorry. And I don't care if they're big or small. You know, there can be a bad small farmer and there can be a good large farmer, right? Do you know that in 1930 or 32, the town of Petaluma in Sonoma County had more money on deposit in a bank than any bank in the world? And that's because they had figured out how to have chickens line up and lay a lot of eggs and sell them and ship them because they had the rivers and they could go take the sand and they could refrigerate, you know, how they were held. Right. And they were not filled with hormones. They were not abused. Their wings weren't cut. They weren't bred to be, you know what I mean? The point is we can size up and feed people and still feed them good food.
Hear. I'll remind people you can still call in. There's still time to get a word in edgewise if you can. It's tough with Clark around.
No, I'll listen.
718-497-2128 or send your questions to info@heritageradionetwork.com. So let's talk about the argument that people say that, oh, well, that costs too much money. People don't want to spend that much money on food. Food should be cheap. One of the reasons that we've scaled up and sort of doctored this whole system of whether we call it conventional or we just call it, you know, inhuman food or what you want to call it,
right,
is to help people make food cheap or be able to afford food.
You know, again, one of the reasons I love doing the Critical Topics in Food series at NYU in the library, it fails in the reading room, is that we get a chance to have really smart people from different walks of life, always an academic from the Department of Food Studies. Mm-hmm. You've been on the panel before. Mary Nessel is often on the panel. We have chefs and writers and whatnot, is that these are pretty smart people who use really good plain English. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is all of what you just said, which is often proposed by large companies and I would like to say unenlightened individuals, is mm-hmm. just completely incorrect. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to say that it's a lie. I'm not going to say that it's a boondock. I'm just going to say it's incorrect. The fact of the matter is if you eat good food, you get old happy. You do not, you know what I mean? We spend so much less money. This has been said many times, but thank heavens we now have Mark Bittman writing on the op-ed page, The Opinionator, a guy who actually cooks, and it's not even so much I mean, I love what he's choosing to write about. That's mm-hmm. so important. The fact is, we do not spend enough money on food. That's ridiculous. I mean, even in a red state that's very anti all this new thoughtful food system, the first place was a very red area that ran out of organic milk because moms know that they want to give their kids good food. If you tell people the truth, if you don't name it conventional when it's industrial chemical, mm-hmm. then families and people who are caring about their community can actually make intelligent decisions. We're spending, what, 8 or 9 or 10% of our income on food and 19% on healthcare? Oops. I say I will spend 20% on food because I will have a better life. You know, I'll have better skin. I'll have a better sex life. I'll have a better future. I'll have better, healthier offspring. You know, offspring? That doesn't sound nice. Yeah, I'm going upstream to spawn. You know what I'm saying, Mitchell?
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I live by it. I just want people to hear it from someone else.
And it's really, and what I like to do is hear people say it from a lot of different reasons. We just had a panel at Critical Topics about meat. It was called mm-hmm. The Meat of the Matter, the Changing Center of the American Plate. And I really wanted to know, I mean, Betty Fussell, who's a great food historian, sure. wrote this wonderful book about the whole meat industry, talked about how the reason we went to fresh beef is because we could butcher it, refrigerate it, and ship it. And we had been eating salt pork. And in New York City, if you were hungry, you went out and shot a pig because they were running in the street. You know, so for us, beef was this fresh thing. We're never going to go away from meat. It's a birthright in America. But in point of fact, we don't have to eat as much of it. We want to have beef that's well-raised, that's with flavor, that gives us a satisfaction, that's properly aged and stored, and that is at the center of some of our plates. You know, we're not plowing the back 40 anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't need that many calories anymore. And, I mean, I hasten to admit I can live without Pringles. Anyway, so that's what we like to do. And when we have these conversations, the next conversation we have will be on March 14th. You know, you can see all of our conversations are videotaped and archived at nyutv.edu at the Great. Fails at Food Studies. It's in there. You can find it. You know, you young folks with your technology. You can figure it out. But they're there. And we do that so that students and faculty and as a matter of fact, the connection between the NYU Library and Santa Rosa Junior College, where they have a new $28 million culinary building being built now and 90,000 students and a 300-acre farm. Well, I mean, yeah, a junior college is the future, guys, right? You can afford it. Mm-hmm. You can learn how to learn, right? Mm-hmm. We sent 3,000 of the extra books from the 56,000 book collection at NYU. Yeah, it's amazing. Out there, and they watch some of these programs. They watch them and wrote papers on them when their facility was closed for repair. You know, we want people to be able to do that. Our next one is March 14th. It's from 4 to 6 at the library. You'll see it. And there's no cost. We ask for a $10 donation. It's called Yelp Help. Are we seeing a gradual return to actual expertise in food?
And that's something we can ponder until then. But you don't have to wait to hear Clark until March because you actually have a weekly spot on a radio show.
Yeah, you know,
in Sonoma. Yeah,
I write for the San Francisco Chronicle Voices section of their Inside Scoop, which is their dedicated food section website, on a regular basis. I do some blogging. I wrote a book called American Cheeses for Simon & Schuster. So I do some of those other things.
Of course.
And on KSRO, The Drive, I love to say that, with Steve Jackson, AM radio, every Thursday in Northern California. I'm on sometime between 3 and 6, usually around 4, with chefs, with farmers, with people who are cooking food for people fighting cancer and using those foods to help them stay and be well and recover, people who are starting new programs that are extraordinary, people who do things with food in such a broad range of experience that it's just a joy and it's a hoot. It's okay to have a sense of humor about food and still take it absolutely seriously.
Fantastic. I think those are words to live by. Thank you so much for joining us out here in Bushwick at Roberta's.
My pleasure.
And next week, we will welcome Doug Quint and Brian Petroff, who you might know better as the Big Gay Ice Cream Guys. They are big and gay, and they serve a lot of ice cream, and they're a blast, and we're going to be talking about all sorts of things. In fact, I want to talk about gay trucks and various stuff. This is Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. We're here every Wednesday live from Roberta's, and just remember that before next Wednesday, you should eat something delicious. In fact, everything you eat should be delicious.
その時電話のベルが私
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.